Well, thanks a lot for having me here. It's a pleasure to be back. So indeed, I'm going to be telling you about entanglement entropy. And I really going to focus today on mostly entanglement properties of highly excited eigenstate of many body Hamiltonians, while most people have been focusing on ground state and so on. And you see, the question I have in the back of my mind is this question: what is different between generic many-body quantum Hamiltonians and integrable Hamiltonians? Okay, so that's in the back of my mind. So this is the outline. So for the introduction, I want to tell you a bit about the experiments I have in the back of my mind that I want to understand. I also want to tell you a bit about classical and quantum integrability, because I'm going to be talking about integrable and non-integrable systems. And then the rest of the talk is about entanglement entropy. So I would say at this point, I'm going to give you the most important message of this talk. So I really encourage you to ask questions. We can stop at any of these points, okay? The more we discuss is probably the better. And then I will summarize this talk. So, okay, so what are the experiments? So I'm going to be telling you about integral and non-integral systems. So what kind of systems have a transition between integral and non-integral? And those are one-dimensional systems. So they come in different flavors. I somehow favor the optical lattice flavor, maybe because there are a couple of those experiments one floor under my office. So the way experimentalists can create one-dimensional systems is they can create both Einstein condensate and load them in these two-dimensional optical lattices. And what happens is that those lattices trap the atoms in the maxima or minima, depending on something that is called the tuning of the lattice, okay? So now, how should you think about this? So you have an array now of one-dimensional systems, and they are one-dimensional because all those atoms in there, they are in the ground state of the transverse direction of these traps, okay? So all the dynamics really happens along one dimension, okay? So you think about, you have these tubes, ground state of the transverse, everything happens along one dimension. So, and they are very cold, and that's great, because essentially what happens is that in one dimension, very cold, they only interact through this contact interaction. And the experimentalists, they can tune this strength by, you see, tuning the power of the laser and changing the three-dimensional scattering length. Okay? Now, why are those systems so special? The reason is, if you have a one-dimensional system of identical bosons interacting with contact interactions, this is described by a model introduced by Lipp and Linegar in 63, and it's exactly solvable. Okay, that model can be exactly solved, and they actually did get all the thermodynamics of the model. Now, if experimentally you can control this and make it very large, you can go a limit in which this is infinity. And not only is the model exactly solvable in that limit, it's actually mappable onto non-interacting fermions. And you see that in real space, if this is infinity, you can think of this as the equivalent of the Pauli exclusion principle in real space. Okay, so the experiments were actually done in the group of Dave Weiss there at Penn State. And this is one of the quantities they measure, this G2 correlation. Okay, we tell you about the overlap of the bosons. And they can change this parameter gamma, which in the Lipp-Linegar model parameterizes everything. Okay, you see, it depends on the ratio of this G1d and the density. Okay, now they can change this parameter gamma by changing the omega perp, this the lattice depth, it's the power on the lasers, or by changing the trapping to make this density smaller. So that's why they can access a wide range of values of gamma. And these are the experimental values. And you see what happening here. So as gamma increases, you are going to this limit. So this goes to zero. It should be zero in the for fermions. And then it's one because of this normalization in the non-interacting Bose gas. So this line is the theoretical prediction from the Lipp-Linegar model. Okay, no free parameters. So you see that it perfectly matches that. This is all equilibrium. The other thing they can do is they can add another weaker lattice in this direction, and then you get bosons on a lattice. And that model, in the limit in which this repulsion on the lattice side is infinity, you can map into a spin model that I'm going to be mentioning, is the XX model. It was exactly solved too. And now in here, again, are our experimental results in the group of Emmanuel Bloch. The points are the experimental data for the momentum distribution function, which they measure during time of flight. And the line is the prediction of the exact theoretical result. And you see that they match perfectly. Okay, so now that's great. That only tells you that those systems in equilibrium are very well described by that model. Now, the real great thing happens when you take them out of equilibrium. And that's something that Dave did in 2006. So he had these Bose gases there. He applied two laser pulses and took them very far from equilibrium. And you see a different values of this parameter gamma that I showed you there. And then he waited. And after a long time, he saw that the momentum distribution function equilibrated, so it stopped changing in time. But that momentum distribution function was not what you expect from thermal equilibrium, which is something like this dashed line. Okay, so essentially, they show for the first time that you can have a system equilibrate to something that is not described by statistical mechanics. Okay, so there have been other experiments in iron chips, but I'm not going to be talking about them, that have also seen this phenomenon, in which the system equilibrated, but it's not the thermal equilibrium prediction. Okay? Now, let me show you how remarkable this is, because you want to compare to something else, right? I mean, here I'm just telling you it's not equilibrated. It's not thermalized. It's not described by thermal equilibrium. Let me show you results from a more recent experiment done in the group of Ben Leff at Stanford. And the only change in here is that these are different atoms and they have dipolar interactions, okay? So now let's see what happens. So in here, you can see the actual dynamics. This is in a number of periods, okay, that give you a time scale, or in really milliseconds. And it's exactly the same setup. Take them out of equilibrium, the initial momentum distribution function has these two peaks. And this is what happens as a function of time. Now, this is what happens in three dimensions, where the gas is very, very dilute, but very far from any integrable point. And what you see is very rapidly it goes to that distribution I was telling you that looks like thermal equilibrium. Okay? Now, if you put it in 1D, right, carry the same experiment, now the atoms, I mean, density has increased because they are confined in 1D. The atoms collide much more, but you don't get in the same time nowhere close to that thermal equilibrium distribution. Okay, so in this experiment, then because they have a tune, they could change magnetic fields and change the dipolar interactions, he could actually, by changing some angle of the magnetic field, tune the time that it takes for the system to thermalize. And you see it here, from 3 seconds to half a second. Okay, so but this is really the kind of thing that I want to understand is what is it so different between this integrable and non-integrable systems at high energies in the spectrum. So you see, this is very far from the ground state. So this is not ground state physics. So you are a lot of energy. Why is it that they are so different? Okay? So now let's see. Let me try to put some framework for you to think about these systems, because I already mentioned integrability, non-integrability. In classical mechanics, this is somehow These are very clear concepts. So if you put a particle to bounce in some cavity, and you have a circular cavity, you get like the trajectory looks like this. And you see, given the initial conditions that we put in here, there are places of this cavity that are never visited by the particle, right? So if you do a time average in here, right, you are never gonna get the same thing that you will get if you do a microcanonical ensemble. Right, so these integrable systems are special, and they are very well defined. So a system is said to be integrable if it has as many functional independent constants of the motion in involution as degrees of freedom. Right, and we know what's happening here. We have 2 degrees of freedom. We have two constants of the motion, right? Energy and angular momentum. So as soon as you change, okay, the geometry, you see that things change dramatically, and this is a Gurimovich stadium, so you see that after the particle collides a bit, so it's being all over the place. And as a matter of fact, if you start with the two slightly different right angles, what you will find is that very quickly the particles are going to be in completely two uncorrelated places in here. And that we call chaos, okay, exponential sensitivity to the initial conditions. It's a question.
Are the definitions of reproducibility and the kills here mutually exclusive?
Yeah, they are. So essentially, because when this is true, and there is a theorem, it's called the Liouville integrability theorem, that guarantees that the dynamics is regular and so on. So that's right. Okay, any other question about that? Good, so now going to quantum mechanics is a bit more complicated, okay? And the definition of integrability there is something that is still subject of debate. Okay, so I don't want to spend much time on that, but I want to give you a picture, something for you to have in mind of, if I want to think of an integrable system, how do I think of it in physical terms? Okay, and I'm going to give you that picture in the context of many particle integrable systems. And this goes under the name of scattering without diffraction, and you can read about it in this beautiful book. So you see, if you have particle scattering in one dimension, there is something that is special about one dimension. Right? So if you have two particles scatter, okay, they have a well-defined momentum, because of momentum and energy conservation, and they are identical particles, so we are all be thinking about identical particles, so you know that the same incoming momentum that you have, they have to be outgoing, right? So two particle collisions cannot change whatever distribution of the incoming momentum that you have, right? So you need more than two. You need something that allows you to get away from this constraint. And indeed, if you have three particles in one dimension, at some point, if they scatter, the three come together, energy and momentum are not enough to constrain the outcome of the momentum. And then what's going to happen is that you have all possible outcomes, so including the ones which are the same that were ingoing. Okay? So in integrable models, what happens is that these processes, this diffractive scattering, so essentially that the outgoing could be different from the ingoing, is just forbidden. Okay? So that's a way for you to think about integrability. If you have three particles incoming with some momenta, they go out with the same momentum, four, five, and so on. Okay? So, and that's what is called like scattering without diffraction. Very special. So you see, you need very special interaction potential for that to be true. It is true for the delta potential in the 1D Liouville-Negre gas. Okay? Everyone sees that? Now, quantum. So how do you want to think about quantum non-integrability or quantum chaos? And that's going to be related, and you will see it throughout this talk, it's going to be related to random matrix theory. And you know, random matrix theory was something developed by Wigner and Dyson in the 50s and early 60s. And they were thinking about nuclei. And they came up with this, somehow, if you look at it, a crazy idea. Well, this is all too complicated. Let's take random matrices, and we are going to be able to describe not the levels, but the distribution of the spaces. Okay, and indeed it works amazingly. So this is the distribution that one predicts, this Wigner-Dyson distribution, and the experimental results are these lines that show the histogram that show that is correct. Okay, so now the connection somehow between classical integrability and chaos and quantum integrability and chaos, it goes through conjectures. Actually, there are there's very few one can prove. So for integrable systems, it goes under this very tower conjecture that says that what they conjecture is that the level statistics, okay, of systems whose classical counterpart, quantum systems, whose classical counterpart is integrable, is described by the Poisson distribution. So essentially, like you have a sequence of independent random numbers. Okay. On the other hand, if you have a quantum chaotic classical counterpart, then the distribution of level spacing is given by this Wigner-Dyson distribution. Okay. So those are conjectures, and you can come up with counterexamples. It's something that I discussed today in the morning with some of you. How well it works? So look at it in here. So this is the distribution of level spacing for a particle in a rectangular cavity. And this is in this other cavity, which is chaotic, and you see it's perfect. In this case, Poisson, and in this case, Wigner-Dyson distribution. Right? Okay, but at this point you may ask, right? So, okay, you talk about lattice Hamiltonians, it's in the title of the talk. So what happens if you have a lattice model that doesn't have a classical counterpart? Okay, so it turns out that this still works. So let me show you how it works. So you are gonna see many flavors of this Hamiltonian today. This is a Hamiltonian of spinless fermions in a chain, in one-dimensional lattice. And you see they have hopping nearest neighbor interactions, nearest neighbor and hopping next nearest neighbor and interaction next nearest neighbor. Okay? So it turns out that if you don't have these two terms in here, this model is integrable. Okay? You can map it in what is called in the spin language the spin 1/2 XXZ chain. Okay? So this is known to be quantum integrable, and this breaks integrability. So what you can do now is take this Hamiltonian, put it in the biggest lattice you can diagonalize, and look at the level spacing distribution. And this is what you get for different values of this T prime, B prime. Okay, so this is the integrable limit, and you see the perfect Poisson distribution. And now as you break integrability, you see that the distribution transitions to the Wigner-Dyson distribution, which is given in red. Okay? So,
Like a smooth transition?
That's right. For finite systems, that's a smooth transition. And then you need to worry. So what are these distributions? Right? And to understand what these distributions are, you need to do a finite size scaling analysis. Right? So we cannot solve larger systems at what is solving here, which is actually 24 sites at third filling, but we can definitely solve smaller systems. Okay? So now what you can do is just take the point here, the top, the maximum on the distribution, and plot it as a function of this parameter, the one that breaks integrability. For this larger system that I am showing you here, this is the behavior. So you see, it's moved, and it moved to this value, and this is the prediction from random metric theory. Okay? Now if you decrease the system size, you see that it moved to a larger value. So what you want to think is that if you reverse this and increase system size to go to the thermodynamic limit, based on these small systems, what you expect is that the transition will happen at zero, at infinitesimal T prime B prime. Okay? So from here, essentially, one could conclude that there is no proof that in the thermodynamic limit, really, whenever you have a non-zero T prime B prime, essentially, you get a Wigner-Dyson distribution. Okay, so in the thermodynamic limit, then we only have two distributions, right? Exactly zero, we get Poisson. Non-zero order one, you get the Wigner-Dyson distribution. Okay, but the important message here is that you see this still works for a system that doesn't have a classical counterpart.
You see a sign of it even at very low energy, so you don't need many eigenstates to.
These, okay, that's a good question. How did I get these results? Actually, these are gotten, I think, with a 50% in the center of the spectrum. So indeed, you have to be careful with what's happening at low and very high energies in these systems with a bounded spectrum. So that's right. So the finite size effects are going to be stronger the lower the energy. Okay. Okay, other questions? Good. So that tells you that works. Okay, and now we can think of this model as a playground to go and study the transition between integrability and non-integrability and what are the properties of the eigenstates. Okay, good. So one thing that already at that time we were really thinking about is like, can we advance this transition? Can we see that in for T prime, B prime, non-zero, you have chaotic eigenstate, not from level spacing, but from the eigenstate themselves, right? And indeed, I mean, you can compute something like this information entropy. You get the eigenstates at some value of T prime, B prime, and decompose it on some basis. So actually here, we decompose it in the eigenstate of T prime, B prime, zero. So in the integrable eigenstates. And what you see is, of course, by definition in here is zero. But as you increase T prime, B prime, you get a very smooth curve, and it approaches the prediction from random matrix theory. Okay, so you could see it in the eigenstates, except that this result obviously depends on which basis you decompose the states, because if you decompose the state of the integrable model, let's say in the computational basis, like in Fock space, so this is going to be non-zero, right? So at that point, it's something non-universal, and that's the question I'm going to be answering today. So I'm going to be arguing that now we have a universal way of using eigenstates to differentiate between integral and non-integral. Okay, so all this is the motivation. And I can take questions or start like going into the discussion. Okay, so if there are no questions now, let me tell you about the entanglement entropy. So that's where the answer is going to be, an experiment. So what do I mean by entanglement entropy? I'm going to be focusing on a von Neumann entropy, a von Neumann entanglement entropy of pure states. Okay, so what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be looking at the eigenstates of these many-body Hamiltonians, and I'm going to be computing the entanglement entropy. So how do I do that? So I get pure states. I trace some connected parts. So these are going to be in one dimension. So I trace a part of the system. This is pure, but what is left is not pure, right? It's a mixed state. And then I'm going to compute this von Neumann entropy of that remaining part, OK? So in addition to the von Neumann entropy, there are also the Reyni entropies, but I'm going to be focusing in this talk on this von Neumann entropy. OK, so now what is very important that you have in mind for the rest of the talk, this is very different from what is traditionally done, which is to study the ground state entanglement entropies. And they are very important and very interesting because there are area laws. They allow you to tell things about quantum phase transition. They also allow you to find out whether you can essentially solve some problem numerically or not, ground states and so on. Not what I'm going to be doing here, right? I'm going to be looking at highly excited states. And now somehow recent development is that now those entanglement entropies, and especially the Reyni 2, have been measuring experiments. So, and this is one of those experiments during Greiner's group at Harvard, in which they look at the Reyni 2. You see, they look at a system with six sides, and then as a function of tracing, or the remaining part of the system having some volume, and it goes from zero to six, and they look at the ground state. They can look at after a quench, the system has equilibrated. You see, it's larger than for the ground state, and then they can compare to thermal and so on. So it's something that can be done experimentally, at least in small system size. Okay, so now a big question is, as in the, I was showing you for the classical and the quantum systems, the reference, we need some reference to compare things to, right? So in here, for the level spacing, I had the reference was random matrix theory, okay, or Poisson distribution. So what reference do we have for entanglement entropies? So we didn't have a reference for integrable systems, but for non-integrable systems, which you could think, oh, generic state, we do have a reference, and it's the one given by Page work. And what Page was doing is like, well, suppose you now look at random states in the Hilbert space, okay, and you take them with a uniform distribution in the unit sphere. So what is the average entanglement entropy that they are going to have, right? So they are pure, and then he got this result, and this is in this limit. So dA is the Hilbert space dimension of a subsystem that you are looking at. D is the total Hilbert space dimension. And we are in this limit to get this nice expression in which everything is larger than 1, much larger than 1, and this is smaller than this. Okay. So now let me walk you through some of the important things that you should look at in this expression. The first one is the leading term. So since the Hilbert space dimension, I mean, the log of that is usually the volume, the size of the number of sides that you have, you immediately see that for this average, the leading term scales with the volume of the subsystem, okay? Very different from ground state where you have area law. Okay, the second thing is that typical, essentially the ones given by this random, this average of random state, pure states are nearly maximal entangled. And why is that? Because, okay, this is the maximal value you can have. Let's take a look at this numbering here. Well, this is exponentially small when your subsystem fraction is less than half of the entire system. okay, this ratio of Hilbert space dimension is something exponentially small. And then it is exactly 1/2 when the subsystem fraction is 1/2 of the system size. Okay, simply because this square is equal to this. So what does that tell you? So it tells you that not only do you have a volume law, the correction is either exponentially small or order one. Okay? So now what is it that I'm going to do? What I'm going to do is I'm going to do numerical experiments in, again, this model I showed you before, except that now I'm going to write it in the spin language. And I'm going to compare what I get for different regimes. So you see, in here, if you get this and this zero, the system is mappable to free fermions. This is the XX model that you get in the experiment that I was telling you when you put the lattice and you go to this U over J infinity. Okay, it's exactly that limit. So if delta is non-zero, but this is zero, then it's an interacting integrable model. And if the two are non-zero, it's non-integral. Okay? Mm-hmm.
So in Chris's equation, what's the next leading order correction?
What?
What's the next leading order correction?
I mean, there is the next one, but this one is exponentially small. I mean, oh, that is a good question. I don't know what is in the when you get the 1/2. You would like to know what the other one is, 1/L or what have you, right? I mean, I would guess it's exponentially small, but yeah, I don't know what is the next one.
Actually. It's 1/D squared.
It's 1/D squared. Oh, 1/D squared. Okay, so it's essentially that exponential, right? Good. Okay, other questions? So now I'm going to show you the most important plot of this talk. I mean, we can stop the talk after this. So this is now, what I'm showing you here is this average. I solve for the entire spectrum of a chain with 22 sites. I focus on the zero magnetization sector, is the largest one. And I do the average. I compute the entanglement entropy of all the eigenstates as a function of the subsystem fraction that I'm looking at after tracing the complement, do the average, and that's what I'm plotting here. Okay? So what are the limiting curves? So this is Page curve, and this is another curve I'm going to be discussing with you. These are non-interacting fermions without any conservation law for which we have analytical bounds that I'm going to show you. Okay, so let's say we have insight about these two curves analytically, and now the rest are the numerical results. So if you look at the non-integrable model, it's very close to Page, but not quite Page. Okay? You look at the free fermions with this fixed magnetization, it's very close to the free fermions without this constraint, but not quite there. Okay? And then you can look at the interacting integrable model, and it's in between the two. Right? So of course, this is all for a finite system, and the question is, how do these things move when you increase the system size? Right? So that's what I'm going to show you next. So now what I'm doing here, you see, is a scaling of this average for the non-integrable model and the free fermion, so namely for this and for this, as I increase system size, but I'm not plotting the scaling as a function of LA or L. I'm actually plotting as a function of this prediction from Page for the maximal value, which is when VA is equal to 1/2 of V. Okay, so that's what in here you see is called S bar run max. So what that tells us, and we are fixing here the subsystem fraction to be 1/2 of the system size. So what is it that I'm doing here? I'm focusing on this point, and I am looking how this scale with increasing system size, okay? And this point in the middle and this point. Okay, everyone sees that? So the non-integrable model, we see that it extrapolates to one. So from here, we would say in the thermodynamic limit, we are going to get exactly Page. Okay? The integrable one, the non-interacting one, the free fermions, it extrapolates to that other result that I'm going to be discussing that we have analytic understanding. Okay? That's great, because now we have these physical systems that, in the thermodynamic limit, we believe that they are perfectly described from things that we can understand analytically. Now the question is, what happens for the interacting integrable model, right? Does it go up or down? So anyone wants to take a guess? and say why they guess it. Okay, so, well, it goes down. It actually goes, and now I'm plotting it for different values of this delta parameter. And this is a plot with a single parameter fit to a constant divided by this square root. So you see in here is linear, in here this square root. And for all these parameters, we see it extrapolate very well described by a constant divided by square root of this S maximum going to the free fermionic limit. Okay, for different parameters delta. Okay, so that's pretty amazing, but maybe some of you feel uncomfortable about the fact that I already set the limit in here in the thermodynamic limit to be that number. So you may ask, well, what happens if you change that? So we did an error analysis of what happens. Okay, so this is the error of our fit if we change this point. So you see, we move that point around the exact the result for free fermions. And you see, I mean, the minimum error is very close to that value, but it's not at that value. It's actually below that value, which is counterintuitive. So that's why, but these are all finite system sizes, okay? So we think that it's very likely that really in the thermodynamic limit is gonna be this value and not something like this. Okay, but we have no proof. At this point, what I'm telling you is essentially we have a strong evidence to believe that if you take quantum chaotic models, right, compute the spectrum, look at the entanglement entropy, the average is going to be the one given by Page. And if you look at integrable models, it doesn't matter whether they're interacting or not, you are going to get this non-interacting limit result. And these are all translational invariants. Okay? So that would be like the main message of the talk. I'm going to emphasize it again at the end. It means that not only do you have now the level space in distribution, but actually the entanglement entropies from the eigenstates can tell you whether a model is non-integral or integral. Okay. So what I'm going to be doing next then is really discuss the analytic understanding of this limit and this limit. Okay. But as far as the big picture is already given here. So if you look at the entanglement entropy, you can really differentiate integrable and non-integrable models. So I can take questions here if there are about this point.
Mm-hmm. So I'm guessing that probably XXZ model, most of the, say, you can solve that exactly, and then most of this, they actually, when you go to large enough system size, they actually essentially looks like free fermion like, meaning that you just write down some kind of free fermion.
Not so obvious to me, actually. Yeah.
Really?
I see.
But
yeah.
I guess I'm asking, say, there might be some kind of model that the integrable model that the eigenstate in large enough system size, they say free particle wave function would be
right.
Good answers. Would that be the same situation or?
I mean, they find the model. I mean, I mean, the intuition from here is that that's not the case. That if you look at this average entanglement entropy, which is dominated by the very high energy states in the center of the spectrum, the interactions somehow play no role. You get the same whether it is free or not. So one requirement here that is important is that the system is translational invariant.
Also, another quick question. So, is it possible that, say, in XXZ model, other than those scatter state, there are some bound state of the quasi particles? Oh, but those are probably just like vanishing poor
fractions. That's right. They are there. They are there. Now, I'm going to show you some things that will tell you about the distribution. Of course, these are average, right? I didn't tell you how the distribution are, right? And indeed, all over the place for the integrable model, you get states with very low entanglement. Okay, so which are those states that you are thinking about? Okay, other questions? Okay, so this is actually not the way that the whole thing historically developed for us. So we really started looking at quadratic fermionic Hamiltonians because we wanted to find a way to move away from Page. So somehow there was Page result, and it's like, can you have a model whose eigenstate don't satisfy Page, because we play with the chaotic one, they satisfy Page. So quadratic fermionic Hamiltonians are those models, okay? So what we did is we took a 1D chain, free fermions on a chain, And then we, this is a problem that we can solve for much larger system sizes. Now you see 36, we build the entire spectrum. This is 2^36 state, and then we did the tracing, and we can even get the distribution. So you were asking about distribution. So the color in here tells you how many states are that have this particular average entanglement entropy. Okay, and what you see is that you get some state with very low entropy, some state with very high entropy, but most of them are here. Okay, so this line is the average I showed you before. Okay, so you immediately see that it's very different from Page, and there were also early results in 2D for free fermions showing that something that was different from Page. Okay, so we got this, and then we started thinking, can we understand that, right? Can we understand that analytically? And we realized that we could actually understand analytically things about the most general translational invariant quadratic Hamiltonian. Okay, some things we understand even for this most general one. And the reason we can do that is because we can still diagonalize them. I mean, all you need to do is introduce a Bogoliubov transformation and a Fourier transform. It's very important. Everything in here is translational invariant. Okay, and you can generate all the many-body eigenstates. Okay, they are Gaussian states. They are characterized by this one-body correlation matrix. Okay, you give me the one-body correlation matrix, I can tell you any correlation function using weak theorem. Okay, there is still a non-trivial step going from this to the entanglement entropy, but this gentleman in here, they actually took that step. And it's amazing because in these quadratic models, the entanglement entropy of the eigenstates are given by this formula in which now what enters here are matrices that are the part of this matrix that lives in your subsystem. So you see, usually the things that enter in this entanglement entropy are matrices that are Hilbert space size, right? So in here, this is polynomial in the system size. Okay, so this is a humongous reduction in the complexity of computing entanglement entropy from generic systems. Okay, you see that? Because it's all given by this one-body correlation matrix. Now, this is still tough, right? Because you have this trace of a function log that function. So the next step that was important to make analytic progress was to realize that you can bound the eigenvalues of this reduced matrix. And you can bound it to be that smaller or equal to 1. And you can understand that physically because these are occupation of fermionic states in real space. Okay, so that's the physics picture. But that's great because that allows you to bound the powers of those traces. And they are all bounded by this 2VA, right? When it's when you take the coefficients to be 1. And now if you have that, then you can take this expression and do an expansion. And that expansion is guaranteed to be convergent, okay? So there is a final step to make analytic progress is that, okay, you have this for one state. Well, you will have to compute this for that state. That's still tough. If you do the average over all states, then what you can show is that these traces can be computed using correlation functions of the binomial distribution. Okay, that's the final step that goes into getting analytical result for this. So now you have the binomial distribution. If you compute correlation function, you get these powers. Okay? So now because of the way you see these are even powers and we have the minus in here, then we can easily get bounds, right? Because if we truncate, we get an upper bound. If we replace other terms like higher order terms with a large number, we can get a lower bound. And that's it, right? So right there, you can get the lower and upper bound for that average in terms of something that is simple to compute. So it's actually so simple that in this case, the bounds are universal independent of the parameter of the Hamiltonian that I showed you before. So this result is valid for any, for any value of these parameters, okay? For all quadratic fermionic Hamiltonian. Okay, so now let's take a look at the bounds. What do the bounds have? So the first thing that you have is that if VA over V is 0, vanishing subsystem fraction, you see this is gone, this is gone. It tells you that the entropy, the average, is VA log 2. That's Page result. So even for free particles, if you have a vanishing subsystem fraction, you get the maximal entanglement. But as soon as this is non-zero, then you see that you have a correction, okay, to this log two. Okay? So then you can work a bit harder and you see what happens if you go to truncate at N2, and then you start seeing some structure emerging. You see on this side and on this side, you get the same result. And then you can get some asymptotic expansion now for the lower terms in powers of LA over L. Okay? So and that's great. So I can tell you what the status is now. Lucas developed a diagrammatic technique to be able to go to fourth order. And this is what we have. So this dashed line here is the terms that have converged in the expansion. So you see in here is only these two terms. So but up to four, this is what the convergent part will tell you. And then you have the lower bound, you see is very close to the actual numerical result and the upper bound. So we really now know rigorously that these models depart from page result, which is this line. Okay, so and the final thing is, which I'm not going to get, is very technical. Of course, you also want to know about the distribution. Some of you were asking about what are the minima and values of the entanglement. And the distribution, it has a width, and the width is vanishing in the thermodynamic limit at 1 over the square root of the system size or faster. So what that means is that typical states, okay, in the thermodynamic limit will have the average value, okay, because the width of the distribution is vanishing. And that's important because maybe you have that average, but it's the superposition of a big bunch of very large and a big bunch of zeros, not what is happening, okay? Most of the states have actually the average. That's what we've shown with this. That's an important result. Okay, so that's what I meant by we have an analytic understanding of that curve I showed you before. Okay? So, I mean, later we were then thinking, well, what happens to spin models that map to fermions in which there is an issue with boundary conditions? So we actually studied that. I'm not going to go through this. And we show that the leading term, even for those spin models, is the same as for the translational invariant quadratic model. Okay, that's something that may concern you because the boundary conditions can change depending on whether you have an even number of fermions or not. And the other thing that we argue in this paper was that the leading terms chose that volume-low scaling, which is universal for all translational invariant models. That we don't have a proof. We really just look at different classes of translational invariant quadratic models, and we found that they all gave the same result. Okay? Uh-huh.
Do you assume the models to be local?
That's a great question. No. Okay? So that's a great question. As a matter of fact, these results, you know, I was saying this is the free fermions on a chain. It doesn't change now if you connect all sides to all sides, because you still have the plane wave to be the solution. So the locality will change where the states are in the spectrum, but not the average. So that's right. There is no locality imposed in there. Okay?
So actually dimension doesn't matter if the
locality. That is another excellent point. Dimension, the dimensionality of the system doesn't matter so long as you keep connected parts. Okay? You cannot then now look at a big bunch of bubbles. Okay? Okay, so let me conclude this part with the slide I started with. So I started showing you this line. I told you we got this numerically from this Hamiltonian. Now, from our studies of this problem, what we believe is that this line is actually universal for all translational invariant quadratic Hamiltonians. And it's likely to be universal actually for all translational invariant integrable models, including the interacting ones. Okay? So that's the current status of that line. Okay? So if there are questions about this, I can take them now or then move towards the understanding of the quantum chaotic case. Uh-huh.
Can that curve be computed for genetic CFT?
I don't know. I mean, remember, these are all highly excited states. So I think there you can do a lot at low energies, and but I'm not sure that that you can get anything for highly excited states. Okay, in the CFTs. Okay, other questions? Good. So that's the bottom, right, of the results I show you. Now let's take a look at the top. Okay, so there have been several works on average entanglement entropy of quantum chaotic Hamiltonian. So essentially the question we focus is, what is the effect of adding conservation laws? In particular, that particle number conservation. And you see, the answer is not obvious, because integrable models, you could think of them as adding an extensive number of conservation laws to a non-integrable one. That gives you integrability, right? So if you are extensive, you get an extensive correction. What if you add order one? What kind of correction do you get? Is it something that vanishes in the thermodynamic limit or not? And how is it scales with the system size? Okay, good. So let's try to answer that question. So again, the way we go about this is we do numerical experiments on models, and then we do some analytic understanding of some particular states. Okay, so in here again, we are going to do now numerics on the 1D chain I showed you before, written in the third way you can write it. So on purpose, I have shown it to you written in terms of fermions, in terms of spins. You can write it also in terms of hardcore bosons. Okay? So we are going to solve this guy, compute the eigenstate, look at the entanglement entropy. And we are going to take just random canonical states, okay, which are generated this way. This Z is a normally distributed real number. And the important thing that is different from Page is that this J are base k with n particles. Okay? In Page result, there was no constraint on what is the filling there. So now we are going to constrain it to have n particles. Okay? So there was no restriction, I mean, in spin language to be in the zero magnetization or in the particle language to be at half filling. Here we are going to constrain it to be in a particular filling. Okay? And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to compute the entanglement entropy of these guys and compare it to the entanglement entropy of these guys, okay, the average. So this is what you get. Good. So let's take some time to go through these curves, because you see you have four curves, and each curve shows one filling fraction, right? So if I fix my filling fraction to be 1/2, I get this green curve. Right? So essentially, the number of particles is 1/2 of the Lattice sites. If I fix it to be 1/3, I get this curve, and then 1/4, I get this curve, and then 1/6, I get this curve. So the first thing is that the slope of that Page curve will depend on that filling fraction. Okay? This I'm going to show you, you understand that analytically. Now, what is the other important thing that you should see? In each, you know, set of data here, there are actually four set of results. So filled symbols are random, the result for random states. Open symbols are the result for eigenstates. And the first thing you see is at this level, you don't see the difference between them, right? You take the average over the random state and over the eigenstate, you get the same result. Okay? And this line is the maximal value. I'm going to show you what this is, how we compute that. We call it the mean field result.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. So the eigenstate from the Hamiltonian will have definite particle number.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you comparing with the random canonicals?
Because I want to impose in the random states that they have a fixed particle number. Okay? So I want them to have the same. I want to be able, look, I mean, of course, if I compare, like, I mean, you just see it in here, right? If I don't put that constraint, I will not describe anything, right? Page curve is just this line. While I know that if I take these guys with different feelings, I get different results, right? Okay.
I misunderstood something.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So good. So then that's what you get, right? Now the first thing you say, like, okay, so what is the effect of this particle number conservation at half filling? Let's take a look at how this guy scale, remember, with increasing system size, as I did before. And this is this inset. So if you take the random, you see, remember, random states are field symbol. You see that it scales actually exponentially quickly, and now this is the average minus this mean field. I'm going to tell you what this is. one half. That's exactly page, right? If I do the states of the Hamiltonian, it also extrapolates to the same number, but differently. So that other, the next to that term, right? Someone was asking what happens after the one half, is different between these guys and these guys. But both have the same leading and subleading one half. Okay? Everyone sees that? So if I add half filling with particle number conservation, up to an order one thing I'm going to show you, I just get page. Good? If you try to do the same away from half filling, it doesn't work. The correction is not order one. Okay? Okay, so let's see what the correction is and how is it that we went about calculating it. So this is what we want to calculate. And that's tough, is the average of the trace of row log row. So what we did is we introduced this new operator, which is we call the fluctuation. So you see it tells you rho minus the average. Okay, so now if you put it in here and write rho a in terms of this, you get this expression, which you can split in three. You get this term, and this term. So you see this is what I'm going to call mean field, the maximal value. Okay, everyone sees that? So this term is zero, right? You see it in there because they have an average and an average, and this is the only non-average, but the average of this is zero, right? You see it here, averaging here equal to this. Okay, so by doing this, I just have to compute this guy and this guy, right? So how we do that, you use Stirling approximation, and then you replace some by integral, and then you have to calculate some Gaussian integrals. And this is what you get for the mean field result, what I call the maximal value possible. You get a term that is volume law as page, and then now you get a coefficient depends on n. That's why it's important to have n. This is actually in this paper. So we did have to work a bit more because we were interested in order one correction, so this is the order one correction. Okay? So this result, right, so is the these are the lines in here. Now, there are two lines in here, dash and continuous, because we calculate the exact result for this numerically and compare it to this prediction. Okay, these are the two lines. And you see they are perfect agreement, right? See, the system size are large enough that analytic result, the closed expression form, is exactly the same that you get numerically. OK, good. So now the question is, what are the fluctuations? No, that's tougher. We were not able to compute it exactly, but we could compute a bound for them. Okay, so this term is actually negative. That's why you have a minus here. And what the bound tells us is that it's smaller, okay, always smaller than this bound. And look at what the bound has. So the first term in the bound is square root of the volume of the system. Okay, so it's telling you that you have a correction that is not volume law is sub-extensive, but it's large. It's the square root. And then this is the next term. Okay, so this is telling you that the actual curve in the numerics has to be below the curve that this bound predicts. Okay, and the bound is the square root of the volume. So if you look actually at the canonical ensemble at infinite temperature and you look at what is the correction to the leading term, you find that it's logarithmic. So this is pretty large. Okay, it's not the same thing that you get if you do statistical mechanics. Okay, now of course you are going to say, well, how good is that bound? Right? And this is now numerical results for how good that bound is, again, scaling with increasing system size. So remember, now I'm computing the average minus the mean field and divided by square root of LA because now I know the scaling. And in the thermodynamic limit, the claim is that should be order one, right? And that's what you get. So now what are all the curves in here? So these symbols are the bound computed exactly, okay? Numerically, right? So this line are the bound in this closed form expression. Right, and you see that for large system size, they are very close for two filling fractions. Now, these points in here are the numerical result for random states, and the blue points are for eigenstates. Okay, so what is it that we get from here is that in the thermodynamic limit, it seems that the bound is saturated. And that is exactly the same prefactor for random states and exact eigenstates. Okay? So that is essentially the understanding then that we have for the quantum chaotic states, right? For eigenstate of quantum chaotic Hamiltonians, we are saying there is a leading volume law that is just page, and then there is a sub-leading correction that is a square root of the volume at 1/2 the system fraction, and that occurs only if you are away from half field. Okay? Which are things that you need to take into account when you are studying like finite systems. Okay? So that's our understanding of the upper curve with conservation laws. So I should tell you that you could ask, well, how about energy conservation? Well, it does exactly the same. So there is this recent paper by Chaitanya Murthy and Mark Shrinicki, in which they argue that the correction is square root of n if you have energy conservation, not particle number conservation, but energy conservation. Okay? So it seems to be something general. Okay? So that's for the upper curve. So now you could ask a final question, which is, wow, that's amazing, because you are saying that the entanglement entropy of the eigenstate of a real Hamiltonian is really described by just random states, I mean, of the overwhelming majority of the states. So, but entanglement entropy is something that very abstract. So how are they observable? Are there things that you can compute in random matrices that that also, like physical observables, that are also present in real Hamiltonians? So let me show you one of those things. So in random matrix theory, you could ask, what are the matrix elements of Hermitian operator in random matrices? And the thing with random matrices is that the eigenvectors are random orthogonal unit vectors in arbitrary basis. So suppose that you want to take this average and tell about what is the average for the diagonal or the off-diagonal matrix element. So you immediately find that the diagonals, you know, it's just order one, it's just given by this average of the eigenvalues of the operator, well, the off-diagonals are zero. Okay, that's the leading term. If you want to know more, you have to go find the first correction, and what you can show is that the fluctuations of the diagonals are related to the magnitude of the off-diagonal. And the amazing thing is that the prefactor is a number that depends on the ensembles, whether you have random matrices that are real or complex. Okay, and this actually allows you to have an ansatz for the matrix elements of Hermitian operator in random matrices. It looks like this. Something order one for the diagonal, something exponentially small in the system size, or one over a square root of the dimension of the matrix, and some random number, right? So this prefactor, right, it's a number, one, two, something that you can go and check in eigenstates. And we actually did that for the 2D transfer Ising model. We look at those variances in the spectrum. So this is these variances plotted as a function of the location in the spectrum. So this is like nearly 200,000 states. And what you find is that the random matrix prediction is exactly what you get from this ratio. Okay, so it's amazing. So this random matrix predictions go beyond entanglement, they go into observables. Okay, how is a physical system different from this? Well, there is no structure, you see it in here, in random matrices. So in real systems, there is a structure, and that's essentially what this eigenstate thermalization hypothesis captures. So it says that the matrix elements have some a smooth part, a function of the energy, the diagonal, and something exponentially small you see in the thermodynamic entropy of the system. Okay? So, and this has been tested extensively, so that's not captured by random matrix theory. And in particular, this part in here that things become smooth is something that have been looked at in many models. So I can show you results, let's say, for a 2D transverse field easing model. And you get, if you plot the matrix elements as a function of the energy, there are two integrable limits, actually even classical. When this epsilon and g are zero, then you have the classical Ising. And when this is zero, then you just have spins in a field. And you see these two limits, that obviously doesn't occur. But at intermediate values, you see you have this smooth function of the energy for this diagonal part. So, and that goes into explaining why thermalization occurs and so on, but that I won't have time to cover. So this is all I essentially wanted to tell you. So I cover several things. So let's see if I want you to take two messages out of this talk, are these two, okay? So the first one is that the entanglement properties of typical eigenstates of integrable models are different from those of non-integrable ones, okay? So the same way that you always hear that the level spacing distribution is different, I argue that the entanglement entropy is different. And you can use it to tell whether a model is integrable or not. As a matter of fact, I haven't found any way to cheat this prescription of integrability and non-integrability as opposed to the one for the level spacing. I have many ways of cheating the level spacing. This one, I haven't found a way to go around it, okay? So it's safer. So that's the main message, okay? So if you want to take only one thing, it's just that. If you want to take another thing, then I will give you this second message. That when you go to generic system, quantum chaotic Hamiltonians, you say, well, there is some random matrix description. Usually you think, oh, well, the leading term may be given by random matrix. Well, I'm telling you that not only the leading term, but the first sub-leading term, when it is order one or greater, like this order one is the 1/2 or a square root of n, I show you that the physical model and random matrix prediction agree. Okay? So essentially, random matrix can tell you a lot, and they are universal. Okay? That would be the second message. The rest, you can forget about it if you are not working in this field. So with that, I'm going to stop. I want to thank my collaborator, Leo, who was the major force behind many of these results, and thank the support of these agencies, and thank you for your attention.
So I guess questions, and I think this situation to first students. Yes, if there are any questions from students.
It was too clear.
So actually, I have a question about the, you mentioned there's an experiment about Reni2.
Right.
All of these things also should be okay for the Reni2, no, there's no difference.
Well, the Renis have some, like the page prediction for the Renis have been discussed, and then there are curvatures and so on in the, so it's not a straight line for the Reni.
But also,
the von Neumann bounds the Renis, right? The Renis are below.
Yeah. But if, for instance, if you were, are you thinking of this as also in terms of experiments, like how
right?
This may be tricky.
For experiments, it will be tricky because how will they get the eigenstates and so on, right? But so is the level spacing distribution in experiments, right? So I think it's theoretically is important, and then also for us to think about. What is it that determines the difference between those entanglement entropies? I mean, why is it that those the integrable systems, right, that don't thermalize and don't satisfy ETH and so on, the entanglement is extensive, but the difference from the maximal is extensive.
Yeah. Right?
So while the quantum chaotic, the entanglement is extensive, but the difference from that extensive part is sub-extensive, right?
Any other questions? If not, I guess we can.